Welcome back to Observations. This is our second episode in a what hopefully will be a long series of recorded programs for both podcast and for archival retrieval. They're being posted on YouTube, and they're being posted at the BlessYahweh.com website for you to listen to. The purpose of the program is to introduce our listeners to God, to understand who He is, why He created the universe, what He wants, what He's offering, how to capitalize upon it, and to understand man, mankind, and human institutions as they distance themselves and their followers from God. Now, in that first episode, guys, we were speaking about the nature of Yahusha and what he did. One of the things that is interesting about him is that while he would cite the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and did so often, he mostly spoke from the heart about what was said in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. For example, his second longest discussion is the what's called the Olivet Discourse. It's found late in Matanya, just prior to him fulfilling Pesach. And in the Olivet Discourse, almost every aspect of it is a review of the prophet Zechariah. And Zechariah means to remember Yah. But it's not throughout it a direct citation, word for word, but instead a presentation of what it says from the heart. And it struck me that that's what we're doing on this program. We may do a number of programs that way. We'll do other programs where we actually read what Yahweh said. We will consider every nuance of every word so that we have a full appreciation of it, precisely what he said. And we'll do most programs that way. But occasionally, we're going to present Yahweh's nature, his plan, his family-oriented covenant relationship, his invitations to meet from the heart. And I always wondered, guys, when I was reading the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and it says, you know, you should love Yahweh, your God, with all of your mind, with all of your soul, and with all of your heart. Why it would say heart? And then I came to realize that Yahweh is going to write his Torah, he says, on our heart when he returns on Yom Kippurim in year 6000 Yah, which is 2033, and Yom Kippurim occurs on sundown on October 2nd on the Roman pagan calendar in 2033. He says at that moment he is going to write his Torah in our heart. And what he is saying is that the eyes are a marvelous tool, for example, to observe. We can use our eyes to read. We can use our eyes to observe what's happening around us. We can use our ears to listen when we're talking about what God has to offer, who he is and what he has to say. So that's a means of observing what is happening around us, the evidence that's available to us to consider. And then we have these marvelous brains with this unique tool that Yahweh gave us. And what is the only uniqueness between animals and a very specific animal, humankind? In the creation story, how does Yahweh differentiate man from all the other animals that have a soul?
He gave him a nesama.
Yeah, a nesama.
Nefesh is soul.
Yeah, the nefesh is soul. Nesama is a conscience. A nefesh is consciousness. That's the difference between animals and plants. With animals, they're capable of observing their environment and responding to it. A plant cannot observe its environment and respond to it. They don't have a nefesh soul, a consciousness. But the difference between humans and other animals is that God gave us a nesama, which is a conscience. Right. So with our minds, we can reason. We can think. We can execute good judgment. We can discern between right and wrong, good and bad, truth and lies. And so when we're talking about our brain, that's how our brain was designed to work, so that we observe information, we process it in our brains, we use this nosoma, this sense of judgment, to transition from knowing to understanding, and to making good decisions regarding what we've come to know. And when we have done that, and what we have taken the next step, which is, it's one thing to, and it's hugely beneficial to go from being ignorant to knowing. You know, religions are based on faith, which is based on ignorance. But with the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, Yahweh is absolutely knowable. But, and while knowing Him is hugely superior to being ignorant, to being religious, to being faith-based, knowing only gets you so far.
Or
understanding is required to respond properly. Go ahead.
You don't even have to be religious. Knowing Him is better than just being even agnostic, or, yeah, I think there's a God. I think there's a God. You know,
right.
I believe there's a God. Knowing is far superior to just believing.
Of course, yes, hugely.
So I was just pointing out that you don't have to be religious. I mean, there's people out there that think there's a God, and they're not religious at all. But they still have the chance to know Him, and that would be better than what they're currently doing.
Right. But Hasatan, we began this program by talking about Sharia-compliant airlines and serving halal food, and it's halal bin shakar that is Satan. Yahweh uses the term Baal, which means Lord, to describe Him throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, because that's His nature. He wants to lord over humankind, even wants to lord over God. You know, through this whole process of coming to know God, you need to understand that Hasatan knows God. He knows Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
He not only knows He exists, he knows exactly who He is. Not going to help him any. So you have to go beyond knowing God to have any benefit. And so that transition is from knowing to understanding is using your nesama, your conscience, to exercise good judgment. It's one of the reasons why the most prominent religion today, socialist secular humanism, is based on political correctness, which makes it a sin to be judgmental. Because the moment you acquiesce good judgment, being discriminating and discerning, you can no longer exercise free will in a reasoned moral way. You lose the ability to make informed and rational choices. You are easily manipulated.
You've taken away free will. You've taken away people's free will. That's what
you have.
All of it is done.
Yes. Yeah. This whole idea of freedom in a politically correct culture is meaningless. Is a meaningless concept.
Well, they've done. They've done the same thing that the Catholics did in the first 1,000 years of Christendom, is they took away all the books and kept them to them, and you can't keep away the books, but you can certainly change all the books to read, or you can dummy down the populace mm-hmm. through your universities and your schools, which they did
right.
with progressive education. So,
right.
It's,
you know, they can teach in, I think it was Doctrine. Atlanta schools or Alabama schools, you can, with Georgia schools, that you can teach the Islamic profession of faith, but you can't teach the contradictions and the immoral nature of the Quran.
So there's no open discussion at the end of the lesson.
Right. Correct. Yes. You can refer to Muhammad as the Prophet Muhammad, but you can't say in the popular media or in education that he can't be a prophet because, A, he never issued a single prediction that came true, and the Quran itself admits that he was incapable of prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't call him a prophet and be rational, but yet you cannot say anything other than the Prophet Muhammad in the media or in academia, and anybody who challenges that will not be heard. So, foregoing of free will. So, if we get back to this idea of the heart. So, if we go from, first, ignorance to knowing, that's a huge step forward, to using our nesama, to going from knowing to understanding, now we have empowerment. This idea of understanding now prepare someone for the next step along the way, which is acceptance. Are you willing to embrace what you've come to understand? Are you willing to trust what you've come to understand? Are you willing to accept what you've come to understand? And in this case, the understanding that we're talking about is the guidance that Yahweh provides for us in his Torah about who he is, what he wants, and what he's offering. And so as we make our way from knowing to understanding to accepting, at that point, we are transitioning from something that is in our heads to something that's in our hearts, that's, in essence, part of the very fabric of our lives. Right. It's our perspective. It's our motivation. It's our attitude. It literally creates and defines who we are. And so when you speak from the heart, which you have here, and it mirrors this idea that upon Yahweh's return, when he reaffirms the covenant, he's going to do so by writing his Torah, his guidance, in our heart, that at that point, once you've come to know, and then understand, and then accept, at that point you're able to speak from the heart and communicate the very essence of who God is, what he wants, what he's offering, and the benefits that are to be derived from knowing him. And I suspect, since Yahusha was the living embodiment of the Torah, knew it as well as it could be known since he was its author, and since he understood it as well as could be, as anyone possibly could, since he's the one that conceived it, and since he was the living embodiment of it, he was the totality of what it means to accept it, to trust it, to rely upon it, to deploy it, he was able to speak from the heart and explain the Torah, prophets, and Psalms to us in ways that were facilitated our understanding. So that's why I think so much of what he had to say, he spoke from the heart about what was already written in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and that's how we are beginning today.
Your heart is also where people, that's where people think you're, they credit your emotions and your passions and your drive. You hear all the time, oh, his heart's really in this, you know, and...
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think passion is something that Yahweh appeals to Yahweh a lot. And you know, it is emotional. I mean, he speaks when he recognizes how humankind went astray and became a vicious, religious, and political, militaristic creature that he grieved at even conceiving humankind. And I'm sure that Yahweh grieved as he was going through a thousand-year period where he told us that he was looking for someone with whom he could relate, with whom he could share, with whom he could communicate. Couldn't find anyone. And so when I think when man attacked the diminished manifestation of Yahweh, as Yahusha, I think in all of that time, Yahweh grieves, which means he is emotional just as we're emotional. The fact is that I don't think that's the primary meaning of from the heart. I think the primary meaning from the heart is a wholesale incorporation of what the Torah and its covenant represent into our very nature so that it is who we are. It's how we view the world.
You know, speaking of that, when I translate a word, a Hebrew word, I look at the concrete first as my primary mm-hmm. meaning before I go to the abstract. Because mm-hmm. they were generally, in the ancient words, they were generally given, they were very concrete thinkers before you get to the Greek periods, you know, when we become a lot more abstract thinkers. So mm-hmm. So if I was looking at the same word of whether it be the heart or understanding, being and so forth, I would look at first, what does it mean in the hardcore concrete, and then I'd add all the other stuff to it for a deeper understanding.
Yeah. Yeah, Van, we're going to return to that just in a second. I want to welcome Larry, who's the fourth member of our team into the program. Larry, do you recall the time when we first began to know one another, and you were quoting from the various things that I had written, and I encouraged you to refrain from doing so until you were quoting it as your own, as that what you were quoting from Yahweh was quoting from the from your heart, that this is what God said. You understood what He said, so you weren't quoting from me. You were quoting from the very God you'd come to know, and how much more effective it was going to be when you could quote it as your own.
Yes, I recall that. Yeah.
But made a big difference, didn't it?
I think. Yeah. I mean, you really have to understand the material. That's
right.
And I see what you're getting at. Once it's your own, once it's written in your heart, you own it.
Yeah, you own it. Yeah, it becomes part of the fabric of your life. And it's ultimately empowering, because a person who has accepted something is much more totally empowered to deploy, to convey what they have learned, as someone who understands it but has not accepted it. And as someone who understands material is almost infinitely superior in their ability to deploy it than someone who simply knows the material. You know, like scholars in the university setting, they know an enormous amount about their subject, but they understand very little. And yet there's still this huge chasm between understanding and acceptance or incorporation of the material into the very nature of your life. So that's indeed what we're talking about here, from the heart.
I've got somebody right now on FB. There's two of them telling me that I'm a member of a cult, and you know, they're on another guy's post. His name's Doug White. So I'm sitting here doing the defending. I've shared passage after passage of Yahweh's words, even talking about the Christmas tree and you know, people who call him Lord and all this other stuff, and they go, well, we just happen to disagree. So,
yeah. But who's he disagreeing with? Yeah, is he disagreeing?
You know what I just told him? I said, if you disagree, you're disagreeing with God, not with
That's
me.
Right. Well, actually, it's disagreeing with both, because Yahweh is part of the fabric of your life. Your view and Yahweh's view are the same. And so, yeah, he is disagreeing with you, but the fact he's disagreeing with you is immaterial to him. What should be material to him is that Yahweh's God's own testimony is irrelevant to this person who thinks they are in a religious relationship with God.
Right.
And the fact that they are aligned with a cult that was born out of the most vicious beast that man ever conceived, Rome, and Christianity is a beast of Rome.
Oh, of course.
Then they can't see that. They're unwilling to even consider the stupidity of the religion, of Christmas, of Easter, of Sunday worship, of worshiping God. Imagine a deity so insecure, that deity created a being to worship him. I mean, it's repulsive.
Oh, God dying for one's sins. What God do you worship? I said, I'm not involved in any worship, and if there's any worshiping going on, you're dealing with the wrong God, period. End
Correct.
Of story.
Right. Yes, false gods want to be worshipped. The real God does not.
Right.
It's so demeaning to God to think that he wants to be worshipped. What a ridiculous, moronic, insecure, a perverted God would be.
Mao model type of deity.
Yeah, this is Adolf Hitler as God. Acquiesce and worship me. Salute me. Acknowledge me as the leader. Or, I'm going to torture you. It's just like the idea in the Christianity that all souls go to heaven or hell. What kind of a sadistic God would say, acquiesce to me and to some ritualistic notion, or I'm going to see to it that you're tortured forever in hell?
Hello?
Yeah, halal. Yeah, we're right back to halal, the God of Christianity. And, you know, the person who would call Yahweh's covenant a cult is someone who is unaware of the fact that throughout human history, lies have always been popular, and the truth about God has always been very unpopular. What did Yosha say on the Sermon on the Mount as he began to explain the truth of the Torah and of Yahweh's means to life? Did he say that it was very popular and lots of people know it, or that it was very unpopular and almost no one recognizes it?
The latter of the two, I believe.
Yeah. When Yosha etched in stone the second of the three statements on the first of the two tablets, and he was describing the father's negative influence on their sons, did he say that that was very limited, or said it went on generation after generation after generation?
He said it was generation after generation after generation, and that's exactly what we've got.
Right, exactly. Now, when he said that his mercy would be available to those who observe the terms and conditions of the covenant, did he specify a number of people who would benefit from the terms and conditions of the covenant? Did he use a numerical term?
Yeah, thousands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he said thousands. What is thousands amongst billions?
It's a very rare animal, one in a million or less.
One in a million. Yeah, one in a million. So, by Yahweh's testimony, the truth about who he is, what he's offering, and how to capitalize on it is extraordinarily unpopular. So, if you're part of a religion, if you're part of a political mantra, if you're part of a propagandist national mantra that is popular, you are clinging to something that is not from God. Because he said that the way to death and to the destruction of one's soul was extremely popular, and most people find it. So if the person is clinging to this idea that what we have come to know is unpopular, therefore it's a cult, when in fact they're prescribing something that is popular, by Yahweh's own testimony, they have to be wrong. It doesn't mean that we're right, unless what we say is 100% consistent with what Yahweh says, which it is. But it means absolutely unequivocally that the religion that they are prescribing to, if it is popular, and there's no religion in human history that's ever been as popular as Christianity, that it, by Yahweh's own definition, is wrong. So it's impossible for them to be right.
May I ask?
Sure.
How can you get cult out of observing the Torah?
Because they're not listening.
I mean, that's all we do, guys.
Yeah, because they're not listening, because they don't want to even consider that, because from their perspective, the Torah is dead. You know, Paul, the author of the cult that became Christianity, Paul said that the Torah can be equated to a dead husband. He wrote that in Romans 7. It was probably the most disturbing, most convoluted, most irrational, most disingenuous, delusional statement ever presented in the name of God. And that takes some doing, because you've got Scientology and Mormonism and Islam, which are unbelievably stupid, just ridiculously stupid, to say that Paul's presentation of the Torah as being dead and equating the author of the Torah to a dead husband in Romans 7 is about as bad as it ever could be. And in Galatians, Paul's first letter, now Paul is the founder of the Christian religion, because Yosha was Torah observant. So therefore, there is no Christianity based upon Yosha. It's Paul that is the founder of the Christian religion, that Paul in Galatians said that the Torah can't save. So if we say, and we're speaking the truth, when we say what we are sharing, what we're observing, what we're coming to understand and explaining is the Torah, as it was authored by God himself, Yahweh, they can't process that. They can't even consider it, because from their perverted perspective, the Torah has no merit.
But, But he's,
now, they carry it around in their Holy Bible, but they say that it no longer prevails. Why do they even carry it around if they're not willing to consider its
yeah,
the testimony?
Your load.
Yeah, lighten your load. If it's no longer valuable, if it can no longer save, if it represents a deceased deity who has been replaced by your Jesus Christ, why carry it around?
Yeah, why quote the flood? Why talk about the flood? Why talk about any
right.
of these things? That God's dead.
You right. Why, you why talk about creation?
Prophecies
yeah.
or any of that.
Right.
No, you've invented your own. You've invented your own monster, actually, a
right.
zombie god who runs around
god.
With poor judgment skills that forgives everybody
mm-hmm.
for everything.
Right. Who is a lousy communicator.
Clerics, but then you guys follow the religious clerics.
You know,
right?
According to Paul, the God of the Torah could not save.
Mm-hmm.
The God of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms was impotent, was incompetent. He was mean. He was irrelevant. And that the reason, according to Paul, that the God of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms contracted with him was because he was capable of coming up with a new story, a new plan, based entirely on faith that could accomplish what the God who authored the Torah, prophets, and Psalms could not do. So what do you think the odds are that that's true?
Not at all. First off, not at all. There's no chance. But think about that. He said the creator of all, somebody that he himself has created to be all-knowing, ever-present, can't come up with a plan on his own. That guy needed to come to a human.
So the God that actually created the universe, the God who had enough intelligence, enough energy to conceive the entire universe and make it manifest without diminishing himself, and then had the wherewithal to come up with a plan, a language to author life, which is the most interesting part of creation, and then spoke to that creation, engaged with that creation, and shared his guidance with that creation via the Torah, and then told of that creation's history, past, present, and future, from creation all the way to the demise of this universe as it exists and the creation of a new one, that entity who authored these Torah, prophets, and Psalms, that entity was incapable of saving, was incapable of conceiving a good plan, was incapable of communicating effectively, but a murderous man, who was a sexual pervert by his own admission, who by his own admission was insane, by his own admission was demon-possessed, that individual was God's answer to the world because God was incompetent in this person. Oh, man, yeah, he was smarter, better, and more credible than God.
Not to mention that, like you said, you know, God could see past, present, and future. He had all the components to the equation, but the guy that could only see past and present, or some of the present, that's the guy that he had to go to figure out the plan.
Yeah, and that guy's testimony was not only disingenuous, but why would God, 666 years before this man named Shaul changed his name to Paulos, meaning lowly and little, Shaul means question him, that this man named Shaul, why did God, 666 years before he would write his first letter, that to the Galatians, tell us that Shaul was the plague of death, if in fact he was the way to life?
Well, they want to make him a liar. I think one of the most telling is the breakdown on what Shimon really said about Paul's letters. You know, you know, their catch-all is always 2 Peter 3:16. You know, the one Calvin said proved, you know, that 2 Peter wasn't written by Shimon. You know, because he knew right there that was the end of him. He calls Paulos a sophist.
Right.
Now, once somebody calls you sophist, that's the end. Let me. Would you want anyone who represented Yahweh calling you a sophist, John?
Anyway. No, because that means that you're dependent upon human philosophy and human understanding as it's portrayed in human philosophy, religion, and politics. And that's precisely what he said. And he also went on to say that Paul's letters use circular reasoning and that they lead people astray to their doom.
To destruction. I mean...
To destruction, right. No, there was no one on planet Earth that understood Shaul, Paul, better than Shimon, Peter. And he told us exactly who this demon was.